on this computer. Okay, welcome everyone back to season two of the Jurisprudence Course podcast. We are doing philosophy of sports. We do not have Gideon Yaffe here today, but we are joined by who I would say is like probably the leading philosopher of sport, at least that I know, but I probably think, you know, if you looked around. So one of the things I'd like to talk about today is the incredibly vexed question of tactical fouling, or sometimes it's called strategic fouling. In our course that we taught here together, spent an enormous amount of time on this topic. It's really quite fascinating. So, Mitch, maybe you could just introduce us to the topic, and we can just start jumping off from there, like some examples of tactical fouling and some of the basic problem.
Sure. Sounds good, Scott. Good to see you. And a shout out to Gideon. We miss him. So there's sort of a standard view. There are these rules of sports. You're supposed to comply with them, particularly the regulative rules, those that say do X or more often do not do Y. You're supposed to comply with them. And if you don't, then maybe you're engaged in cheating or some other sort of wrong. And yet, we know that high-level sports, at least, and maybe even often low-level sports as well, are just rife with intentional violations of the rules in contexts in which nobody thinks that this is untoward. So the standard examples are just all sorts of pushing and pulling and hitting in violation of rules by basketball players and soccer players and football players. Happens all the time, and no one thinks it's cheating or some sort of wrong. So that's the basic fact that leads us to think, okay, so then what are the criteria that make a rule violation, an intentional rule violation, the wrong sort?
Right. You gave the example of like stopping the clock. Did you give that?
I didn't, but we talked about that a lot, because I find that really a great example. So sort of the dialectic sometimes goes, someone says, well, here's cheating. It's intentionally violating a rule to gain an advantage, let's say. And then someone says, well, what about intentional fouling in basketball toward the end of a half or to stop the clock by the team that's down? And nobody thinks that's cheating. So that forces us to revise that first pass definition.
Right. So the idea is that you might think that cheating is violating the rules for an advantage, but in tactical fouling, there's violations of rule for an advantage. And I mean, I'm sure some people might think it's cheating, but the general view, the received view, is that no, I mean, this is part of the game. Let's, you know, since this is the jurisprudence of sports and philosophy of sports, let's, you know, one of the great things about philosophy is it introduces distinctions and ideas that allow us to gain some hold on a topic, to kind of explain what is it that's bothering us about it, what's tricky about these situations. And so one of the things that a distinction that arises in law a lot is the distinction between prices and sanctions. Robert Cooter wrote a very famous article about this, I believe, in the 1980s, called, I think, "What Prices and Sanctions." He's not the first one to come up with it, but it's really the kind of locus classicus for this distinction. Can you walk us through this, Mitch, and then see how it might apply here?
Yeah, exactly right. So, take a sign up on the street that says, you know, "Don't park here," and fine for parking here is $25. Well, we could read that as saying you're not allowed to park here. And if you do violate that obligation, then there's going to be a cost imposed upon you, a penalty. And in Cooter's terminology, if we think of it that way, you're prohibited from doing this, and there is a penalty for imposed upon the violation. We would call that a sanction. Or one might think, you're allowed to park here, but if you do, then you're at risk of having to pay a fee. So you're allowed to, but it comes with a cost. And if we think of it that way, then the no parking here rule really is better understood as a priced option. Yeah, you have the option of parking here, but it's for a price, maybe some percentage risk of being caught here and being subject to the $25 fine. And there are lots of examples like that where some particular set of a regulatory rule of some sort, something that or a rule that applies to your conduct and has attached to it some sort of cost or penalty can be viewed one way or the other. A great example of this, of course, is the Israeli daycare study. So that's a rule that was a policy at an Israeli
Well,
daycare.
explain this to people because it really is one of these classic experiments which shows that people seem to be attuned to these normative distinctions.
Yeah, exactly right. And it is really well known and sort of eye-opening because it was done so nicely. The idea is we've got a text, a rule governing text that says, let's say on its face, come and pick your kid up by 4 o'clock. Don't be late. And that's what it says. And then that's all it says. And then they change it, the policy, to say, pick your kid up at 4 o'clock. And if you come more than 15 minutes late, you have to pay $20. Well, what it in practice, we've the investigators found that parents were leaving their kids a lot more. They were keeping them late a lot more than they used to. Why is that? Well, because once the penalty was announced, it seemed to convert the prohibition in the minds of the parents into a priced option. Now, it says, even though the rule still said, don't be late, the parents read it as saying, pick them up on time for no extra fee, or if you choose, pick them up late and pay $20. And they said, that seems like a good option. That's what I'll do.
Right. So it's so it that actually sounds a bit like tactical fouling,
Yeah.
because it looks like what the parents are doing is they're fouling, so to speak, the teachers, because actually the teachers had to stay late. So it's like tactical fouling, but they're like, this is okay because the rule has been converted from a sanction into a price. Now, what's really interesting, and this goes to directly the question that we're talking about right now, is that the Israeli rule said it was a fine. So like a fine sounds a bit like a sanction. Like if you told me that you were fined for something, I would think that you were being penalized, not like that this is something that's completely up to you. Like the most obvious case of a price is like if you go to the post office and you buy a stamp, right? They're not penalizing you 25 cents or something for sending a mail or taxes. They're not penalizing you for making money. They're just saying if you make money, the certain money they have to take this. So now the question is, if the question of tactical fouling, the permissible of tactical fouling, is whether the rules that are being violated, whether they are backed by sanctions, in which case you shouldn't do it, or by a price, in which case it is permissible for you to do it. I guess the question is, how do we know whether a given rule is imposing a fine, a sanction, or a price?
Well, you appealed to the text in the rule book. So sometimes it may say this is a fine, or it might say this is a sanction, and then that should resolve it, possibly. First thing to point out, of course, is that sometimes it doesn't. So it might say the penalty is X, And the thought here is that the word penalty is ambiguous between the two concepts, price and sanction. And there are good examples in sports where the same term penalty is used in different contexts, where it seems in context it's meant to signal either a price for an option or a sanction for a prohibition. But furthermore, sometimes the rules do say things like shall not, no player shall do X, and if they do, then this is the consequence. Or they may sometimes say it is illegal to. Rule books use that type of deontic and legal language a lot. If you think that the plain meaning of the rule governing text resolves the question of what the norm is, that is, whether the normative thing is a prohibition or a permission, if you think that's fully resolved by just the ordinary communicative contents of the provision in the rule book, then sure, the fact that a rule says no player shall should resolve it.
So,
But of course, most of us don't think that, yeah?
well, so maybe you don't, maybe I don't, but maybe some people in the listeners are. So let's explore this idea.
Yeah.
Okay. So I believe, like in the literature, they call this formalism. This would be the word that they would use for this way of thinking about it. Is like the kind of what Ronald Dworkin would have called the rule book conception. Like it's you look in the rules, you see what the rules say. If the rules say it's a penalty, then you treat it as a penalty.
Well, just remember, penalty we're assuming right now is the more general term, which is
Okay.
ambiguous as between price and sanction. I think that's helpful to think of it that way.
I
Just so,
see. Okay, yeah. So I guess if it see, I guess I would put it this way. One way you might think of distinguishing between permissible tactical fouls and those that are not is you look at the rules. You see what the rules say.
yeah.
If the rules say, it is illegal to do this, it is wrong to do this, it is a grave wrong to do this. I mean, if they set if there's a very severe penalty imposed, like the one side forfeits or something like that. So you might read off of the rules themselves what's permissible or what's not. But lots of instances, that's going to be very difficult, right? I mean, it's not like the rules of baseball, basketball, football, golf, whatever. They're not extraordinarily clear about the distinction between prices and sanctions.
Well, I guess I don't know. I wouldn't put it quite that way, Scott. I think that the rules most often do speak in terms that convey prohibitiveness, that it's prohibited. So let me give you an example, okay? Here's a concrete example. This is NBA Rule 12B, Section 1A. You know what that says, but for
Yeah, of
our
course.
listeners, I'll just
Yeah,
recite it.
sure. I mean, yeah, I
Yeah?
mean, I know the rule book for everything. That's why I was allowed to teach the course. Go ahead.
A player shall not hold, push, charge into, impede the progress of an opponent by extending a hand, forearm, leg, or knee, blah, blah, blah. Contact that results in the rerouting of an opponent is a foul, which must be called immediately. Okay. So there, a player shall not hold. It's not saying a player may hold on for this price. And there are other rules which do say that. I could give you a rule from golf. There's a rule from golf that says if a player hits their ball into a hazard, then they have the option of dropping it here or placing it here for a penalty of one stroke. So they use the penalty language, which is ambiguous, but there they say you may. Here the rule book in basketball says no player shall, right? That if you are a formalist or a textualist about this, then you're disposed to say, well, that answers it. The rule is a prohibition, and the stated penalty for the foul is a sanction. Sanctions go with prohibitions, prices go with options. It says you shall not, so it's a prohibition. But what makes that a hard position to maintain is that it's inconsistent with the views of all the participants in the practice. Nobody, at least in some cases, so for the purposes of clock stopping fouls in particular,
Yeah,
when.
what do we get, do you, I mean, do you have the rule in front of you about clock
No,
stopping
there is
fouls?
no, that's the thing, there's no specific rule for that. It's just conduct. That's the rule that I just mentioned you.
Oh, okay. Okay, I
Right, so I'm identifying a type of behavior that's a subtype for the broader type that falls within the communicative content of that particular rule provision, right? So
Right.
when someone when a team or player on a team that's down a couple of points at the end of the game fouls the team with the ball, the reason the official will blow the whistle and stop play and call a foul is because the player has just violated that part of the rule that says a player shall not hold, push into, etc.
Right. Okay. So the dialectic is as follows. We think that whether tactical fouling should be allowed depends on whether the rule in question is backed by a sanction in which it shouldn't be allowed to versus a price in which case they should be allowed to. How do you tell whether a rule does one or the other? Well, you look at the rules, you look at the language, you look at the rule book, and you see what it says. If you look at the clock stopping fouls, it's not crystal clear, but it is somewhat suggestive by using words like shall under the penalty of. Is that that's the language, right? What is the exact language about
No,
the.
it just says the penalty provisions generally are separate in the rule books, just
Okay.
like in a criminal code. The offenses say what you're not supposed to do, and then there'll be another section that lists the punishments in the case of a criminal code or the magnitudes of the penalties in the case of, say, most sports rule books. So it
Do
just says that this is a foul that must be called immediately.
I
That's
see.
what it
I see. And fouls that must be called immediately stop the clock.
Anytime you blow, if you
Yeah.
blow the whistle,
Right.
that
Okay.
stops the clock. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay. So if you just look at the language, then it seems as if you're a formalist, you're going to say that hacking Shaq, you know, that is like trying to get, you know, try to foul Shaq so that he shoots a free throw, and he used to be very bad at that. Or if you to try to stop the clock, you might think that this is unacceptable. Except that at least with respect to clock stopping fouls, the general view is that it is acceptable. When it comes to hacking Shaq, maybe it's a little people have a little bit of a different view.
Exactly. So I start with particular cases in mind or types of cases. And if anything, you've understated it. Nobody thinks that fouls intended to stop the clock so that the team that's behind has some chance of getting the ball back and therefore eliminating the gap in scores. Nobody thinks that that's not kosher within the game. Nobody would call that cheating. If a team does it over and over, nobody in the opposing team would say, come on, you got to stop doing that. It's just a recognized part of the game. And if someone were to read the rule book and say, hey, you're not allowed to do this, I think any basketball insider would say to that person, no, you don't really understand the rules. That's what the rule book says. But really, the rules allow you to foul to stop the clock under these circumstances, right?
Okay, right, great. So, like, if you're watching a NBA basketball game and it's close and towards the end and there's a foul, you don't go, "Oh my God, what am I watching here?" In fact, you might do the opposite. If there's no fouls to stop the clock for the team that's behind, you might think, "What? Wow, this is not competent play, not to foul." Which, if you want to accept the idea that it's okay to foul to stop the clock in the NBA, even though the rule book like on the plain reading would seem to suggest not. The idea might be that the right way to understand the rules of sports are not the rule book conception, not the formalist conception, but something like the word I believe is conventionalism that they use in philosophy of sports. The idea being that what the rules are what the participants or maybe the spectators or the community, what they understand the rules to be, what is the shared understanding? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. So it's like the old, was it the pound distinction between the law in the books and the law in action. So the thought here for a conventionalist, the thought is that the way the game is played, the way the rules are put into operation in practice, really tells us what the rules are. They're not just evidence of it, maybe they're constitutive. They help make the rules what they are. For the formalist or textualist, it's For the textualist, it would be something like the ordinary communicative content of the provision in the rule book is what determines or constitutes the rule. And for a conventionalist, the way it's practiced is what determines the rule. But of course, as you point out, then there are going to be lots of debates at the margins, and not only at the margins, about what exactly is the practice, and the practice among whom? The participants or the officials or the fans or what have you. But in some cases, there really can be a very broad consistency, shared understanding of what the practice is among all sorts of participants at various different levels or different categories.
Right. So I is this wrong to think, but I think of the conventionalist in sports as a bit like the positivist in law. Would you accept that, Mitch?
I think a lot of the formalists could be positivists as well, right? It depends upon your positivist theory. So
I guess that's right. You could have a very bad positivist theory
exactly.
that's formalist, right? Right. Okay. So so clock stopping fouls fall if we had this the kind of a continuum from most everyone agrees that this is permissible. You put clock stopping fouls. What else would you put there?
Well, that's the clearest example. So you're already rightly, you're leading us to the right way of thinking of it. I think of it in sort of tripartite way. There are some rules which read as prohibitions and are genuine prohibitions, and if you violate them, you're doing something wrong, like you're cheating, like marking cards in a deck, or not actually running the distance of a race course in a race, cutting corners in a race. That's just clear, it's violation of the rules and it's cheating. And then we've got these other things, best exemplified by clock stopping fouls, which are against the plain meaning of the provision in the rule book, clearly aren't cheating, but that's because most of us think, rightly understood, it's not even against the rules. Then the interesting category is that intermediate category. Those are the interesting cases of tactical infractions or tactical fouls, where we want to say, unlike the clock stopping fouls, which are we think really are permitted, this other category we think isn't fully permitted, but nor is the violation the really bad type that's we sometimes call cheating. At least that's the way I think of it.
Okay, so actually, I'm curious that you said what you had said about clock stopping fouls, that is permissible. What? Why is the okay. On the view you're taking, it's permissible because even though it says shall not, and even though there's a penalty attached to it's a price. And that is the proper way to interpret the rule that is in accordance with the shared understanding. And even though the rule says you're not doing it, that is, you shouldn't do it, that's just setting up a price. So when a foul is called, like foul suggests like something you did that was wrong, but that's just the word we use rather than the concept we're employing.
Totally. And here's further good evidence that that's right, at least in this case. Imagine that a player on the defensive team fouls a player on the offensive team who has the ball at the very end of a game in order to stop the clock so the defensive team can get the ball back and have a chance to possibly tie or win. Okay? And imagine that the official doesn't blow the whistle. Who has a gripe? It seems to me that the defensive team has a gripe because what they're saying is that although the communicative content of the rule book suggests that this is a sanction-backed prohibition, it has morphed over time, as a conventionalist would think is certainly possible, into not only a permission, but in fact a power. And it's evidence of the fact that the defensive team has a power. This is a way of the defensive team being able to stop the clock so that they have a chance to come back in a game that is governed by the clock. So the fact that if you think that you're the team that fouls it and the referee continues to fail to blow the whistle, it's the defensive team that says, hey, you know, you're not, we've got an entitlement here to stop
right,
the clock.
Right. The one who's breaking the rules, so to speak, is the one that's saying they're wronged by the fact that it's not being enforced, which you know, ordinarily would be peculiar. Why are you not putting me in jail, or why are you not charging me, or why are you not garnishing my wages? But because these are tactical situations, we want them to do that. In your experience, what are the, like, can you give us two examples of things that occupy the middle?
Yeah. Great. Well, so one thing is it could be any of the other intentional fouls that you mentioned other than clock stopping, maybe. But here's a great and a well-known example. It was in the FIFA World Cup in South Africa. I'm forgetting the year now. 2016, something like that. It's Ghana against Uruguay. And there's a shot on goal, and I'm going to say Luis Salazar, but I'm getting the name wrong. Who am I thinking of? The Uruguayan player whose name will come to my mind.
It doesn't matter. Nobody's listening anyway. Go ahead.
We're going to get nasty notes from all the soccer fans. So he intentionally handles the ball. He sticks his hand up to stop a clear goal-scoring opportunity, not just a goal-scoring opportunity. It would have been a goal, and Ghana would have won and would have progressed to the knockout stage if he hadn't, it was Luis Suarez, if he doesn't stick his hand up and intentionally handle the ball. It's basically goaltending in soccer. Now, this is a case where, unlike, I think, and the rules say, this is actually interesting, we can, you know, footnote, we can return to it maybe, but let's just assume, as most soccer fans think, the rules say, thou shalt not intentionally handle the ball unless you're a goalie, okay? The provision doesn't actually read quite that way, but I don't think our soccer fans are going to object that much. But in this case, unlike the clock-stopping foul, nobody thinks that it is permitted full stop. No one is going to be a conventionalist about this and say, you know, it happens all the time, and everyone recognizes that you're allowed to do this. So here, this seems like a case where you are violating the rules, and yet many soccer insiders believed that cheating was too harsh a term. That's what the coach of Uruguay said. That's no surprise. But even players on the Ghanaian team said the same. They said, you know, I would have done the same thing. Cheating is too harsh a word. But they didn't say, as in the clock-stopping case, what are you talking about? The rule reads as a sanction-backed prohibition, but come on, it really is just a priced option. Like, it's perfectly kosher to handle the ball to try to knock it down. No, it's not perfectly kosher, and yet many soccer insiders said, it's not quite cheating. Those are the interesting cases that force us to think, okay, what then does have to be added to an intentional rule violation? Because this does seem to be a rule violation, unlike the clock stopping, which is only a nominal rule violation, but not a true rule violation. This is a true rule violation, and yet not the type that is truly prohibited, I want to say, or is prohibited underlined. And that's the interesting case.
Right. So, I mean, this is this is a beautiful philosophical question because it's really you feel pulled both in both directions. One of the things that we did in the class is like various people proposed their view about like what is the added ingredient that converts a tactical foul into cheating, or what is the thing that's not there that makes it permissible? Gideon had a view, but since he's not here, I can all tell you that it was wrong. Did you? No, Gideon's always right about everything, but did you? Because he's so crazy smart. Do you have a view, Mitch?
I've got sort of a view. Here, the general, my view is best understood if I just tell you very quickly what I think is sort of the dominant view out there. People want to say things like cheating is the intentional violation of a rule to gain an advantage where it violates the ethos of the game, or where it violates the conventions of the game, or the spirit of the game, or something like this, to try to account for the fact that there's plenty of rule violations which aren't really inconsistent with the ethos or spirit or convention and are not cheating even if they're not fully permitted. And I think most people think that something like that is right, but underspecified and not that informative, unless we can give an account of it. It just looks sort of hand waving or a black box, right? Now we do want some account of what makes it the case that a particular rule violation is or is not consistent with the ethos or the conventions or the spirit.
Right. So, this almost is where somebody like Ronald Dworkin in law would say to the conventionalist or the positivist, look, your things only work in the obvious cases, but you can't explain these middle cases where people feel not just confused, but lots of times they feel strongly one way or the other, and they know that there's disagreement here. It's not like everyone agrees that this is the ethos of the game. In fact, that the ethos of the game is contested, and yet people still take a view on this.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's a good thing you mentioned Dworkin because we've already put on the table two of the dominant views of sports interpretation or of the legal content of sports, formalism slash textualism, maybe textualism is a subtype of formalism, and conventionalism. And the third type is sort of a Dworkin-inspired view that in the philosophy of sport is often called internalism. And there, the idea is that there are values that are internal to sport as such, and internal to particular sports. And those values are the ones that help make it the case that, give content to the rule, help constitute the actual normativity or actual content of the rules of the system in an anti-positivist way, much the way that Dworkin describes for law. So that's the third major group in the philosophy of sport, the internalists. So their view would be something like, this is prohibited. It would be cheating if that's the interpretation that would show the sport in its best light. To give a sort of cartoonish toy version of the account.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that some of the readings in your wonderful book make the argument that that the problem with tactical fouling is it presents the ethos of the game or the spirit of the game is about winning, as opposed to doing something beautifully or elegantly or skillfully, superhumanly within the constraints of the rules, that somehow it kind of bastardizes the view. I think of this as a bit like what people sometimes say about Christmas, like with all the gift giving and the commercialism, that's kind of ruining it. Like if you said, what's the spirit of Christmas? Like you could say commercialism and giving gifts, because that's what everyone does, but that's not really what the spirit of Christmas is supposed to be. It's supposed to be something like, love, goodwill, religious undertones or something like that. Does that strike you as like a good argument that the problem with tactical fouling is it's presenting the point of the game as though just about winning?
Oh gosh, I think that's. I think there's a lot to that there. I think here's maybe the way I would think about it a little bit. A lot of people would say about professional sports that all of the seeming prohibitions are just priced options, and that elite athletes and professional athletes treat all of the nominal prohibitions as just priced options. They're always going to try to violate it if they can get an advantage. And this suggests that at least people who have this view might be thinking that at least in the mindset of these set of athletes, sport is just the way you were describing. And yet it's pretty revealing that while there are lots of rules that professional athletes do price, they don't price all of them. So I'll just give you two examples, both of which my point here is to sort of suggest that even in the minds of these elite athletes, I think they recognize that there's something else to the sport. So one example comes from tennis. This is Serena Williams when she was accused once of taking coaching from the stands, which you're not allowed to do. Okay. Now, one might think she could say, "Oh yeah, you caught me," in a sense, just like the cornerback in football who's caught grabbing the receiver wouldn't say, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it." Yeah, okay, you got me, 15 yards or spot foul, whatever. And she said, "No, that's not true." This was shortly after she had given birth. She said, "I'm a mother, not a cheater." Close to a quote, I think. But the idea that, whoa, if I had priced the rules in this way to get a perfectly intelligible tactical advantage, that would be unkosher in some way, would be in some way going against the spirit of the rules, not something that we should just slough off. Also, of course, in the Astros, based in the Houston Astros cheating scandal in 2017, that is when they were electronically stealing signs and communicating the signs to the dugout. They also didn't just shrug it off, and other players in the game didn't shrug it off. So Mike Rizzo, who was the manager of the Nationals at the time, said, "It's really important to me that when they now fess up, they don't just say, 'Okay, you got us for doing this thing,' that they use the word cheating. They acknowledge that what they did was against the rules and against the spirit of the rules in some fashion. And it was some sort of wrong." So in order to make that view held not only by romantics, like maybe me and other sport philosophers, but in fact by the professionals in the game, to make that intelligible, I think we do want to take seriously that sport, even at the elite level, is not just mass entertainment, not just a competition, but does have certain internal values that help to contribute to why it merits the type of attention and commitment that so many of us give to it.
Right. I mean, so to use your expression, kind of the seriousness. What was the exact
I
word you
think
used?
that one of the elements of sport that make it is an attitude of warranted seriousness, that people take it seriously, they give a lot of their energies, their commitments to it, they practice for it, they think about it, they work hard at being better at it, and we, who's ever either extending or withholding the judgment that this thing is a sport, believes that that activity and that depth of commitment is intelligible, is rational, because it is reflective of and productive of and demonstrative of certain types of human virtues. So it's the sort of thing that makes sense to participate in the way that people do.
Right. Yeah, it'd be weird if like human being spends 10,000 hours practicing or something in this thing, within a whole kind of context of coaches and leagues and competitions and officials, and then somehow all they think about is they just want to win by hook or by crook. It's a bit like so one of the things that we started with was the Scalia view that the point of sports is amusement, and you're saying, well, actually, probably, it's more plural than that, the goods. But we also want to say, like, it's not just about amusement. It's also not just about winning, because that would do violence to why we not only what we see in the world, but also why humans would invest all this time and energy in this thing, which is structured in a way to manifest certain types of human excellences. But in fact, when it all comes down to it, you're willing to just break the rules. Can I what's the basic take on the hack on ha the hack shack or shacking hack or what would it?
Yeah, I think that that's probably okay. I do think we have to. Let me go back to the point I made about the ethos convention views, and I said, we want to give more content to that. We want some sh what sharper edges. But that said, I think basically in broad strokes, although underspecified, it's right. So insofar as participants in the practice already have coalesced on some sort of view about a behavior. Either they think this is not okay. If they have a view that it's not okay, then it's not okay. If they have a view this is okay, then it is. The inter and I think that's probably the case of hack-a-shack, right? Basically, I think the thought within the professional basketball community is it's not the most attractive part of the game, but people have the ability to improve at free throw shooting. And if a player is very good at making field goals, that is, they've got a very high percentage of sinking the basket if you don't stop them, and they've got a low percentage of hitting the free throw when they go to the line, then sort of that's on them. And you can take advantage of that defect in their game. Just like in football, if you've got a slow cornerback, well, the offensive team is allowed to go after him on long go routes over and over and over.
Right.
But the interesting, so th I guess that's my thought about Hack-a-Shack. The interesting cases, of course, are the ones in which there has not yet developed any view within the community about that specific behavior. Either it's prohibited but okay, or it's prohibited and really not okay. Then can it be that there is agreement within the community, sort of acceptance of principles or considerations that could make it the case, that could inform whether particular behaviors with respect to which there's no agreement
What would you
are
say is
prohibited?
like a particularly live issue right now that where things are up in the air?
Ooh, on cheating or tactical fouls?
Tactical fouls, like, but where the sporting community is unclear with respect to a certain sport about whether this behavior is acceptable.
Well, here's one that I think has undergone some change in baseball. The two main pieces of baseball equipment, of course, are the bat and the ball. And there are rules in the rule book that prohibit the doctoring of either. And yet participants have, throughout baseball history, have sometimes doctored both. So some batters drill holes in their bats and cork it so they can get the bat head around faster. Or pitchers scuff and put substances on the ball so that it has more action when thrown. So one might think, again, if one were a formalist, one would think that both behaviors are equally prohibited and the violation of the rules are equally cheating. And yet, it has long seemed to me, based on my read of what people who are more baseball insiders than I am say, that bat doctoring clearly is impermissible. That's an easy case. That's, let's say, cheating.
Yeah,
Whereas
and ball deflating.
in football,
Yeah,
well, yeah, that's actually another interesting case.
yeah. Yeah,
We could return to that. But at least
yeah.
in baseball, I think a lot of insiders for a long time felt that ball doctoring by the pitcher had a different normative flavor than bat doctoring by the batter did. And even though the formal rules prohibit both equally, I think many insiders thought that actually ball doctoring by the pitcher, that is, spitballing and Vaseline balling and cutting it with a razor or something so it has more action, that's actually sort of fair game. It's not that it's permissible in the same way that clock stopping fouls in basketball are, but it's not cheating. And that, I think, is undergoing some change based on concerted efforts by Major League Baseball formally to put an end to it. So I think that's an instance of something which old timers would have said, yeah, it's prohibited, but it's not cheating. And 10 years from now, I think it's pretty plausible, maybe even right now, insiders are more likely to say, yep, spitballing and the other sorts of behaviors that go under that name now are cheating. So
Yeah, I
that's sort
remember.
of changing.
Yeah, I remember Raleigh Fingers when I was growing up. With the, he would always, they would always accuse him of putting foreign substances on the ball. Because, and my sense about it was that it was a bit rascally.
Yeah, rascally, exactly. And that's why. And Gaylord Perry, a famous spitballer, is in the Hall of Fame. And that's, I think, what explains the difference. So even if a consensus or convergent practice hadn't yet arisen among participants, there are reasons we could point to. Factors, in my language, I could call them principles, that actually are internal to the game of baseball and aren't the same across all sports that help explain why actually scuffballing. Spitballing isn't cheating because it's rascally, because baseball, unlike some other sports, traditionally values gamesmanship and rascally behavior. Golf doesn't. Cricket doesn't. That's why we have the expression it's not cricket. We don't have the expression it's not baseball. Baseball is a game for rogues. And it's the sort of thing which has to be done to some extent in the open. So there is a cleverness and a skill involved in successfully spitballing beyond the skill involved in successfully corking.
Right.
And also there's an ability of the offensive team or the opposing team to protect themselves against it with some degree of vigilance in the case of spitballing. That's not true in bat corking. So I think all of these factors are things we could actually point to explain why it might be the case that bat doctoring is cheating and ball doctoring isn't, without just saying, oh, well, one is within the ethos of the game and the other isn't, in a way that just seems, as I said before, sort of hand wavy.
Right. You know, I have to say, we have finished the class just in terms of the semester, but I my dominant reaction from the class, and you can see this even today, which is that people often think of ethics, questions about abortion and death penalty and discrimination, and all this stuff, like that's uniquely kind of messy and ugly, and we don't have a grip on that, and philosophers and ethicists worry about that. But in fact, actually, when you talk about these things in sports, they're often very messy, they're very often very hard to come to a settled conviction on, and philosophical argument is extraordinarily helpful for making headway in it, but it's it tends not to be as conclusive as other kinds of forms of knowledge, but it's not ethics specific. Anytime that you're thinking about what ought you to do, even if it's sports, which is not exactly an ethics, I mean, there are ethics that play a role in it, obviously, but it's not the same thing as the hot button issues, and people can be very, very confused and twisted about how they should think about it.
Yeah, totally agree. That's partly what makes it so much fun and so interesting. It's similar to other areas. The heat is generally lowered.
Right. The heat is generally
And we can
lowered,
make a
right.
lot of progress on some interesting questions, both substantive questions and also ways of thinking about problems. Where, as I said, the heat is lower, and also it's just plenty of fun as well.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, I mean, it certainly was for me today. So thank you so much, Mitch, as always. And maybe we'll pick up on how to interpret rules next time or some other thing. But this was great. Take care, everyone, and we will see you soon.
Thanks so much, Scott. Great to see you. Have a great week.
Great, thank you.